welcome to the latest edition of Tea with Nettie. I was very lucky to catch Sir Andras Schiff when he touched down in London just to do a streamed Wigmore concert recently, and he very kindly agreed to put aside an hour of his precious time to talk to me. We really focused on Bach, but he was, as usual, incredibly eloquent and enlightening on all sorts of surrounding topics. And we had a very interesting, in-depth time, and I hope you will feel that you've learned something from it as well as I did.
Tea with Nettie.
Well, Andras, hello, and thanks so much for agreeing to talk to me.
Hello, Nettie.
It's going to be so lovely to talk to you. I thought it would be really lovely to hear you talking a bit about Johann Sebastian Bach, because you are so well acquainted with every aspect of him, and you talk so eloquently, and of course you play so eloquently, but we're more used to hearing you playing than talking. And I just thought it would be nice to start off with considering how it is that Johann Sebastian Bach can mean so much to so many different people on so many different levels. Why do you think that is?
Well, it must be the unique spiritual quality of the music. Bach reaches us on every possible level, whether it's emotional, intellectual, physical. The physical aspect is very important, because the fact is that many young people love Bach who don't necessarily love Mozart or Beethoven and Schubert. So why is that? Because there is this this rhythmic vitality in Bach that they can relate to whatever other experiences they have from jazz or popular music or ethnic music. Now, the intellectual aspect is not to be underestimated. Bach is not easy music, never. But it's a compliment. There are no easy ways and no shortcuts. So the more you know about it, the better you understand it, the deeper you will get. But you can listen to Bach on a basic level too, without knowing all the secrets and without having deciphered all the codes. Emotionally, well, that is the hardest to talk about, but it just moves every part of your innermost, of your heart and your soul.
Yes.
I think the religion is important inasmuch that Bach was deeply religious.
Yes.
It is not the music of an atheist.
No.
Now, you, the player or the listener, you don't have to share the very same beliefs. But at the moment of playing Bach or listening to Bach, you have to put yourself on that wave. You have to be on his wavelength.
Yes.
And not he on your wavelength. There is hardly a great composer after Bach that does not recognize the importance of Bach as a father figure,
yes,
of Western classical music.
Mm-hmm.
And what particularly moves me with him is the lack of ego. You said this once very well, that he is not a first person composer.
Oh yes, that was John Butt that said it was John Butt that said that. I told you that he said
John
that.
Butt is a wonderful
yes, that's true. Yes.
Musician. And anyway, so Bach is writing for the community. He is not writing for himself, certainly. He is not also particularly interested in his own fame or reputation, let alone success. And he's like one of those great artists in the Renaissance who built those great cathedrals, medieval cathedrals, and you don't even know their names. And there are hundreds of them, and, you know, sculptors and painters and stonemasons and whatever, and anonymous. Bach is certainly not anonymous, and he wrote this music all by himself. He said that, look, I'm a believer. God gave me this talent, and it is my duty to serve him and to serve the community. So I write cantatas for every other Sunday and for all the festivities, and I just do it as well as I can. And this is what came out of it. But I'm afraid that this lack of egoism, the egocentric view in the arts, in music, it changes already around Mozart.
Do you think it's fair to say that Bach was sure enough of his own worth and quality that it would have rankled to have to write all those sort of humble letters to people who really didn't understand or value his music?
This is what I try to say today when people dispute the fact that arts and politics are inseparable. They aren't, and they never were, and they were not separable in Bach's time. And maybe not only politics, but society as such. And they all had to play the games. So very humble letters were there. But Bach was humble. He knew very well what he could do. No question about that.
Yes.
But not in a way that Beethoven knew.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean, yes. I think you once told me that you start every day by playing Bach on the clavichord. Is that right?
Yes, when the clavichord is here at the moment. I'm talking to you from my London house. I don't have a clavichord here, but in my other homes in Italy and Switzerland, yes. Yes, I always go to the clavichord even before breakfast. The clavichord is my best teacher.
Oh.
It's very delicate, so for those who don't know it, but you know, most of you know what the clavichord is. It was Bach's favorite keyboard instrument, certainly not the harpsichord and the organ. He loved them. He must have been the greatest organ player of all times. But for intimate home music making, it was the clavichord, and you put this into a little room and you play it for yourself or maybe one or two listeners, and that's it, because more than that will not be able to hear it. But it's capable of the most intimate, delicate details. And it can do the Beibung, this vertical vibrato. So when Bach writes in the preface of the Inventions that he wants to emphasize the importance of cantabile keyboard playing, maybe others can play cantabile on a harpsichord, but I cannot. I can only imagine it. But on the clavichord, absolutely. So with most of Bach's keyboard works, with a few exceptions, we can only assume what instrument he had in mind. For example, in the Well-Tempered Clavier. But I would be very sure that most of them are clavichord pieces because of their very intimate and very singing character.
How was it that you came to study with George Malcolm? Because I don't know, did you play the harpsichord with him as well, or did you study on the piano with him?
Look, this is one of the luckiest moments in my life. I don't know how I deserved it, but I certainly wouldn't be the musician I am or person I am had I not met George Malcolm.
Really?
Well, to put it in a nutshell, I have family here in Britain, lovely people who escaped from Hungary in 1956, and they settled here. So in communist Hungary, under very difficult circumstances, but occasionally they would let young people out. So my relative sent me a letter of invitation, and the authorities very graciously allowed me to come to England and spend a couple of summers here without knowing a word of English. So my relatives took this very seriously as education, and I went to school here in the summer or at the end of the term. Uh-huh. It was in Esher, Surrey.
Oh, really?
Where I went to school.
Gosh.
And the kids used to tease me because, you know, you come from Hungary, so you must be hungry.
Oh.
Very hungry.
Really witty.
I remember the terrible school food, and that the only thing I liked was custard.
Oh.
It was the only thing I could eat.
Oh.
Well, anyway, so through my relatives, then I got to know a couple of people here in London through my Hungarian musician friends, Peter and Annie Frankel and George Pauk, who already lived in London. Then I was introduced to a lovely lady, Lady Margaret Lemington. Did you know her?
No, I've never heard of her.
She was a patron of the arts of music, a very nice elder lady who lived on Cadogan Square.
Uh-huh.
And she used to have sort of musical parties where her friends played for a circle of invited guests. And I played there as a little kid. So not as a prodigy. I was never a child prodigy, thank God. But like a musical child. Mm. And then went back to Budapest, and then one day this lady Lemington wrote me a letter that, a friend of mine, George Malcolm, is coming to Budapest to give a harpsichord recital. Mm-hmm. And he needs a page turner.
Mm-hmm.
Because he played all his recitals from the score.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not a very good pianist, but I was an excellent page turner.
Oh.
I was given the honor to turn the pages for George, and he was very pleased. Even he played an encore by Tompkins for two to play.
Oh.
Do you know how people play that?
Oh, anyway,
wow. It's for three hands.
Yes.
So I could do the third hand as an encore.
Oh, brilliant.
I was maybe 14.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he listened to me, and so this became a wonderful, not really a teacher-pupil relationship, but a friendship between different generations. So every time George would come to Hungary, then he would listen to me and comment on my playing very critically. And also, when I was here in England, I would go over to his house on Cheney Walk.
Mm-hmm.
And this was piano. There was not even a harpsichord in his house.
Oh, I see.
He was so well known as a harpsichordist, but it was piano, and there was a clavichord, and then occasionally he would explain to me the secrets and the tricks on the harpsichord. I remember he played a harpsichord by Goebel of Oxford. There were 8 or 12 pedals on this Goebel harpsichord, very intricate devices, so he could do crescendi and diminuendi and whatever on it. A little bit like Wanda Landowska's player.
Oh.
But he did this because he was a musician with such a vivid imagination and fantasy and so musical. So he said, this is how I would sing this phrase by Bach, but I cannot do it on the harpsichord. So I have to find a harpsichord that can do it. And because he was using this type of harpsichord, he was all the time attacked by the critics. He called them the purists. Because they said, why does he play this kind of harpsichord? It didn't exist in Bach's time. There was a critic, Stanley Sadie.
Oh, yes, I remember Stanley Sadie, yes.
George called him Stanley the Sadist. Because he would always go on and, why does he play this harpsichord? But I'm sure that George was right, because music is music, and it has to have life in it, and you cannot compromise because of the limitations of certain instruments. You have to go beyond that. So also at these meetings with George, we would always finish with playing piano duets.
Mm-hmm.
We have this wonderful repertoire of forehand music, and this is how I got to know it. All the Mozart pieces, all the Schuberts, the Slavonic dances of Dvořák, the Brahms pieces, Jeu d'enfant by Georges Bizet.
Oh, yes, it's wonderful, isn't it?
Many things. Mm. And then as I got older, then we even did public concerts on forehand.
Wonderful.
And going back to the beginning of my relationship with George, I had the most wonderful teachers in Hungary, Professor Kadosa, György Kurtág, Ferenc Radosz,
yes.
At least two of these.
I do know two of those, yes.
But there was one thing missing, and that's what I got from George.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow the style of playing Bach, playing Baroque music, even before he gave me the Fitzwilliam Virginal book, I never even heard of it in Hungary.
Oh, really? I suppose you wouldn't
have. He opened a whole new world. Mm. He gave me the C.P.E. Bach Buch, Versuch über die wahre Art, das Klavier zu spielen, in English. And all these treatises, the Leopold Mozart, Quandt, Türk. So he said, play this music on the modern piano, but learn about the style, learn about ornamentation, learn about improvisation, about figured bass. So this combined with my Hungarian teachers, I was pretty lucky, but this was very important in my development.
Fantastic. Wow, what good old Lady Leamington. That's fantastic, isn't it? Good for her. And
also even later, when I started to play and conduct and all those things, again, George Malcolm gave me the lesson for life, that he would never go to a first orchestra rehearsal without bringing his own marked set of parts. He said he learned that from Sir Henry Wood.
Mm.
Who would do this for the entire prom seasons, that in the beginning Henry Wood would conduct the whole season and take every single composition and working all year on each and every part. And George would put very interesting markings in his bass scores with crescendi and decrescendi, but which were very, very musical, and maybe not for the purists, But when he came to a first orchestral rehearsal with the English Chamber Orchestra or with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, then already at the first reading, you had almost an interpretation, and there was very little need to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, in rehearsals, whether it's orchestra or chamber music, the less we talk, the better it is.
Well, that's true. Did he direct then from the keyboard? He didn't conduct, did he? He directed from
sometimes
the keyboard.
Sometimes from the keyboard, but then he conducted also. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful choir conductor. He led the choir of Westminster Cathedral. Benjamin Britten loved that and wrote his Missa Brevis for them. George was a universal musicians that used to be around the time of Bach, not in our times where we have wonderful musicians, but we are much too specialized. You are specialized, let's say, on playing the baroque violin for the baroque music in France between 1690 and 1710.
Oh, I see what you mean.
A musician should compose and improvise and play all the keyboard instruments.
Oh, I see.
Play a
yes.
couple of string instruments.
Yes, I see.
And conduct and lead the choir and teach and lecture. So there are very, very few people who can do all of that.
Yes.
On a very high level.
High level. Yes, it's true. Yes. Although, yes, actually, I can think of a few conductors who play the piano and play the violin well, too. But yes, it's true that it gives you such a better grounding if you really do start with playing at least two instruments, doesn't it?
You have an advantage, although, because you string players, you all take keyboard lessons. I don't play any string instrument, I regret to say.
But you wanted to play the cello. I remember seeing a cello propped up in your house.
I have a cello and I wanted to learn, but it's too late now. I mean, my whole body doesn't want to take it in anymore.
Mm.
Should have started early. But yes, if I had to choose an instrument, it would be the cello. It's never the piano. Never, never.
Really?
Although I don't want to change our repertoire.
No, but the way you play the piano, it always sounds to me as if you are being the colours of different instruments. I don't find that the set of keys on a piano limits you in any way. I can always hear where the violas and the bassoons and the horns are when you play the piano.
I'm glad that comes across, thank you, because that's my intention. And I never want the piano to sound like a piano.
Mm.
Not because it's a semi-mechanical instrument, and it's in the hands of these great composers. It's a wonderful toy. Mm. And more than a toy. It can express a lot of things, but we are playing with a set of illusions.
Yes, yeah.
We cannot produce a perfect legato like you can do on the viola, like certainly. And we all try to imitate the human voice.
Yes.
Yes, a legato, but also articulation. The piano is very good for articulation, so that's how we learn from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then the piano is very good at pronunciation, that you can start each note as if it were a consonant.
Yes.
When it's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, for example, to sustain a long note, it's an impossibility. So we all do it with illusions, and the composers help us, because the minute you have played a note on the piano, it makes a diminuendo, and sooner or later it dies. So how to conceal that? With very very good composition. That so the piano is a polyphonic instrument, and as one note is dying, it is being kept alive by the other voices and yes. by the overtones
yes.
coming from the other voices.
On the forte piano, and you have played forte piano with that. The first time you played with OAE, it was playing Mozart. And the forte piano, which can sustain even less, does that for you hold implications to the tempo that you take if you're playing on a forte piano as opposed to a grand modern piano?
Yes, definitely. And the forte piano is always right. The modern piano is not right because it's, you know, Bach and Mozart and even Beethoven, they didn't know these big monsters. And somehow, when in doubt in Viennese classical music, so from Haydn to Schubert, and always go to the forte piano and you get the right answers. And on modern instruments, we tend to play fast movements much too fast and so-called slow movements much too slow. If you try to play Schubert's B-flat sonata, the last sonata, the first movement, there's a very famous recording by Sviatoslav Richter who... You know, it lasts half a lifetime, this first movement.
Really?
Wonderfully played, but, you know, if you would go on to the forte piano from Schubert's time and just try to play at that tempo, then you have to stop after two chords.
Yeah.
It's just impossible. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the instrument of the composer's time suggests the right tempo. I have no doubt about that.
Yes. Given what you're saying about the fact that the keyboard instruments don't sustain, they can't, except you have your concept, which is so strong that you are the master illusionist of this. But how do you feel about people who arrange keyboard pieces for strings or wind? Does that worry you, or can you see why that happens? I know you're not crazy about arranging in general.
Who am I to worry? It's none of my business. But since you are such a dear friend, and since you ask, yes, it worries me. I'm not a fan of transcriptions.
No.
I don't like transcriptions because it's not even like a translation in literature. Take the Goldberg variations.
Yes.
Very popular now for string trio. And I really dislike this arrangement. And then there are other arrangements for brass quintet and for balalaika orchestra and for accordions. Anything goes. Because poor Bach is not here to protest. My main problem is that the tour de force of this piece is that it's not an ensemble piece.
No, it's true.
Before we talk about this instrument or that instrument, but, you know, it's for one person to play a four-part fugue is a different story from four people playing the same fugue.
Yeah.
And all right, if you recognize that, then we can get to the art of fugue, certainly. That is what I'm practicing all day now. The art of fugue, we really don't know the instrumentation of the art of fugue. However, if you study the score, it's pretty obvious that this is a keyboard piece because it lies perfectly well under two hands. And yet, I think that the art of fugue is such an unparalleled masterpiece, and that it's so beyond everything else that I can very well accept, you know, four string players or four winds playing it. If you don't change the voice leading, if you are faithful to the to the polyphony and the way Bach is treating those three or mostly four voices. Now in the Goldbergs it's the same. When you play the three part canons,
yes,
you can play it on three instruments without damaging the material. But in those other variations, you know, the Goldbergs come in groups of three, and each third is a canon, and the first is a character piece, and the second is always a very virtuoso keyboard piece with hand crossings, etc. And you cannot do that on string instruments or wind instruments without destroying something important. And the fact that it should be played by one person. On the other side of the scale, there are all these horrendous piano transcriptions of Bach's Chaconne, for example. All right, the one by Brahms is very good for the left hand because it's a study to improve your left hand. But even Busoni's, and I am a great, great admirer of Busoni, but the art of this piece and the specialty of this piece is that you build something like a cathedral on four strings.
Yes, and yes.
If you translate that into 88 piano keys, then the magic is gone, don't you think?
That's true. I do think that. But of course, there are those that would say, certainly in his earlier years, Bach did transcribe quite freely between his keyboard pieces and his string pieces, you know, the violin concertos and the harpsichord concertos. And he took Vivaldi violin pieces and transcribed them for keyboard. And he sort of did that in cantatas as well. He'd put something on the organ that used to be on the violin.
Yes, Bach is a great recyclist.
He's a recyclist, so it makes you wonder when you were talking about balalaikas.
but first of all, let's not mistake ourselves for Bach. There is Bach, and here we are. When Bach transcribed Vivaldi and Marcello and all that, these were his models for his own Italian concerto.
Yes.
That's where he learned it. And Bach would never take, for example, a motet of Ockeghem. He would not take a Monteverdi madrigal and transcribe it for the keyboard.
No.
He knew how far he could go.
How far he could go.
And when he does different versions of the same piece in cantatas or keyboard concerto or violin concerto, then he changes the key according to the character of that instrument.
Yes.
And it's not a mechanical transcription like the Imager violin concerto. It starts with crotchets, and the D major keyboard concerto, it starts with quavers, with quaver rests.
Yes.
And there are other differences in the figuration. And let's also remember that in a keyboard concerto there is a left-hand part, which is an added counterpoint. So he had to incorporate that too.
Bach, he was such a practical musician that I suppose he composed for whatever he had around him and the size of ensemble. But I think for, I don't know, a brass quartet for themselves, if they really, really want to play Bach. I mean, I know trombonists play unaccompanied cello suites because they really want to play Bach, you know, and I've heard it played very well on the trombone.
Yes, I did too, and good for them, and I don't want to discourage them, you know. Do it by all means.
But I take your point about the Goldberg variations.
It shouldn't be the norm.
No.
It's almost the norm now. Everything is being transcribed because of the lack of repertoire for certain instruments. So I just think we need less transcriptions and more good new pieces. That's what we need.
Yes.
Never enough.
Yes.
And here, who am I to talk? You know, I play really not enough new music. I'm ashamed. I should be playing much more new music. But, you know, first of all, there is very little that I like. But also, you know, we have to share our workload. For me to keep all this Bach and plus the other things in my head and in my heart and in my fingers, you know, it's a full-time job. I have no energy and time left. A lot of the new music is as wonderful as it is, but you know, to me, even to decipher a Ligeti etude, I'm just not for that. And I have now even students and kids, they play it like child's play. At the same time, I give them a Mozart Andante and they don't know what to do with it.
Yes.
So, how do you explain that?
Well, I think a lot of people nowadays, they go to music college and their acquisition of music is not chronological. You know, some people start from contemporary music and work backwards. And for us, we're lucky enough to start with Baroque music and come at it chronologically. You know, the Baroque flows into the classical, which flows into the Romantic style. But
here I'm contradicting myself because with George Malcolm, I was dreaming about olden times when people were so all-round musicians. And yet here we are today. And I certainly cannot do this all.
Well, of course, because in those days there was far less music actually existing out there in Bach's time. And now every possible combination of notes and rhythm seems to have been put together. Yes. And I mean, I found it astonishing that you play all your repertoire from memory. And you play, I mean, you have a vast repertoire.
Well,
and
it's chamber music.
Well, but even that you know from memory. I mean, do you remember that time I was page-turning for you and I sat down with relief and you were playing something rather complicated and you just said, one page back, and I turned two pages at once. But you were still playing. You know, you knew it from ear and you could play it, no problem.
But those are pieces that you have lived with.
Yes.
Still, you know, I'm not finished and not ready, so I will keep looking for new music and hoping to find new inspiration. When I was a kid, I took my first piano lesson. So what did they give me? The little Anna Magdalena Bach pieces and Bartok immediately. So and okay, for children those are folk songs, but Microcosmos is very thorny.
Mm.
So it was very important to learn it as a kid and not to come to it much later.
And also because it is so Hungarian, it seems that when you hear a Hungarian person playing Bartok, it just feels so as if so truthful somehow to me.
Well, when it's good, there I am. I have heard many Hungarians play it very bad.
Oh, have you? So it really?
It doesn't come with a passport.
Oh, okay.
No.
Oh, dear.
Well, it helps. So, but and all the other people can play it just as well if they recognize the idiom, importance of the idiom and get into the language and not to speak the language, but to be acquainted with it.
Like,
but it's the same with English, German, French, Italian, Russian.
Well,
the language is always there.
Yes, it does feel like that when you play the music. I mean, somehow when you're playing Italian music, it really feels so much more singing and joy, you know, sort of as and sunny. I mean, I was just sort of thinking of Italian Baroque music, and then you get sort of very serious, well-enunciated German pieces, you know, with a lot of counterpoint in them. And
there's more gravity.
Yes, there is, isn't there? And I love the way these...
Serious business.
But I love the way the suites, you know, the suites that Bach composes, they have, as you were saying yesterday, all these different nationalities in them of dances. You know, it's a tour of Europe, isn't it?
It's a tour, and it's astonishing how he all got to know all that, because
yes.
He has never been outside of Germany.
And that was because of the printing, was it, that the music could come like Vivaldi rather than the travelling musicians?
There must have been some travelling musicians who played for each other, so he must have heard French musicians and Italian musicians.
Mm.
Not like Handel or Mozart later, who were cosmopolitan composers, but wasn't, and yet he was so well informed.
Well, he was so interested and avid to learn, because the French style, for Bach to write in the French, I mean, just the ornaments in French Baroque music, that's a whole language in itself, isn't it? And some of the ornaments almost have ornaments on them, you know. Really,
yeah.
It's really complicated, isn't it?
Very complicated.
Yes, and I love the way yesterday in your recital, I mean, you do use your inner gal, and it's so graceful. It's just beautiful.
This is, again, I mean, for you, this is obvious, but I must say that in my young years, nobody, certainly not in the pianistic world, no one knew about note inner gal, no one knew about ornamentation. And had I not been with George Malcolm, I wouldn't have known.
Mm.
Very, very wonderful man. Great sense of humor, and he spoke the most beautiful English. I just love to hear him speak.
Oh, and yeah. Do you know who his role models were? Who influenced him?
He spoke often about Tovey, but mostly about. I don't think he knew Tovey, because he's too young for that.
Mm.
But he loved to show me Tovey's writings and Tovey's editions.
Did he?
Uh-huh. So, yes. Landowska, certainly, as a harpsichordist.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, I don't know.
Because I'm trying to work out what year he must have been born, or roughly, because people listening to this might not know, and I'm trying to work it out.
1917, 1918, something like that.
Right,
so
yes.
So we just had his centenary not long ago.
Uh-huh.
It's very nice. I go to Balliol College in Oxford, where I joined them, also because of George, because George was an organ scholar at Balliol.
I see,
he
that's
became
the connection.
A fellow.
Right.
And this meant the world for him. He always spoke about Balliol. So I became an honorary fellow of Balliol, mostly as a homage to George. And I do every year, except for the COVID time now, but try to do every year a George Malcolm memorial concert.
Oh, right.
To keep his name alive, because
that's
now
so nice.
Young generations, they don't even know who he was.
No.
He was the only one who always called me Andrew.
Andrew. Oh, did you?
May I call you Andrew? Because Andras is too difficult for me.
And did you enjoy being called Andrew by him?
By him, yes.
But no one else.
Well, no one else even tried.
No, I shouldn't think they did. Oh, that's lovely to hear about that. Well, we're just so lucky that you could come over yesterday, and so many of us got a chance to hear you playing that.
Well, thank you for
concert. It was really lovely
being here and to listen.
Yeah.
I think it's very important to keep trying.
Yes.
Although, yes, an empty hall and streaming and all that, but it's much more than nothing, and it is live, because it's immediate. It's not
yes.
a recording.
No, it's in real time. And the fact you talk to us as if we were in the hall with you, I mean, that made a big difference.
To talk. Anyway, I think we will get to that form of concert more often. We have to think creatively, like our friend Ivan Fischer That's so wonderful. Yes. We have to invent new forms of concerts and break down the walls.
Yes.
Somehow this routine of somebody comes on stage and takes a bow and starts playing, and maybe that's not the only way.
Maybe not. I think.
Maybe if we say something, maybe not instead of program notes, because I don't want to take away the source of income for those who write wonderful program notes, like Misha Donat.
Yeah.
But maybe we also have something to say about that music, and maybe the listeners would enjoy hearing that, and also to see that we are not strangers from another planet. Thank you.